Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, Senate leaders in housing offered their perspectives on the affordability crisis facing renters and homeowners. And Governor Tim Walz unveils a $2.7 billion bonding proposal, plus the history of gubernatorial portraiture. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. A lack of affordable housing, the effects of the ongoing pandemic, rent stabilization initiatives in Minneapolis and St. Paul, inflation and supply chain issues are just some of the challenges facing Minnesota renters and homeowners. Joining me in the studio is Senator Carrie Dietzick, lead DFL member of the Senate Housing Committee. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
The last time we spoke, it was about the end of the pandemic eviction moratorium and the ensuing off-ramp that was put in place to help renters who'd gotten behind on their rent. In your view, how has that off-ramp worked?
I think we don't have the answers yet. I think part of it has worked. I think it has worked for the court system. It allowed them to adjust their scheduling, having those phases. I think it has some. We had a 15-day notice in there, and I think that has kept some tenants and landlords out of court. We have a June date that if you have an open application that tenants and landlords can still work through, and you can't be evicted if you have that open application. So I think that is helping some, but I think we won't know the true effect for a little while yet to see, you know, did it actually keep people in their homes and did it allow them to get time to actually get the rent help money?
So we have to wait just a little bit longer for news on that. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the last election, voters in Minneapolis and St. Paul approved rent stabilization measures. Now in Minneapolis, city leaders will work to form a policy, but in St. Paul, it is a specific policy that caps rent at a 3% increase. Some local developers are now threatening to halt projects because of that. How should the balance between rent control and development incentives move forward at this point?
So housing remains an overarching component of everything. Like I said at the beginning of the pandemic, how do you go home and how do you stay home if you don't have a home? I think we need to be talking big picture. How do you talk crime and crime control if you're not talking stable, affordable housing in all neighborhoods? How do you talk about student achievement and students not doing well in school when a lot of those might be issues with housing insecurity? So I think we have to look at all of that. And how do you talk about rent control if you have a market that doesn't even allow people to get to rent? When we have 550,000 families paying more than 30% of their rent in Minnesota, that is a problem. So what is the, you know, I don't know if it's rent control, but we need to look at how do we keep people in their homes, because stable housing improves education outcomes, it improves health outcomes, it's keeping kids educated, it helps them with their education now and in the future, so that is our future workforce, and that helps local economies going forward. So we need to look at ways to keep them in their homes, and that's either my bill, Senate File 333, which is Bring It Home Minnesota, that would provide rent subsidies to help stabilize some of these families, or we need to, you know, work with developers, work with communities, and build more very low-income housing.
But what you're saying, though, is that this is a bigger issue than just how much people are paying to find a place to live, because if what they're trying to pay doesn't even get them anywhere, then it's a cascading effect of other problems.
Yep.
Is there a role for a bonding bill in this solution?
If the bonding bill will help pay for that very low income housing, yes. We need to build more housing for those very low income families and those very low income workers. We need to, I think the market in itself is raising wages for some of them, but when you're still paying 50% of your income towards rent, that at a certain point is not sustainable, then you're not paying something else. So, you know, you are food insecure, you're cutting back on drugs. And so this is a systemic problem, and we need to have a holistic approach.
Now, I just read in the paper that Minneapolis is instituting the payments that with
basic
no strings
income.
Attached, basic income, thank you very much. Is that a possible way forward?
It's something we should look at. There was just a random study that just happened in, and it was, so there was a study going on, and it was, I think, somewhere down south, and then it involved a Native American tribe that got some probably gambling money. So they got, as part of an agreement, they got some money, and each family ended up getting about $500 more a month. They were part of this controlled study already going on, and that again showed that just getting that $500 more a month helped stabilize those families. It stabilized housing, it gave the parents more security, it gave the kids more security, and those kids over time, again, their education did better, they were more comfortable in their learning, and so their outcome and their learning potential and their earning potential grew. So I think it does help, and so it, you know, it could be something we look at.
In a December Star Tribune article about the housing market, a Twin Cities realtor said that the current market is unfair to first-time homebuyers because out-of-state corporations are coming in and buying up so many properties, either to turn them into rentals or to flip them. It's shutting out lower-income buyers especially, you know, those first-time homebuyers. Is there a remedy to the outside money that is pouring in?
It's a problem, and it is happening, and that is making this already tight market tighter because individuals can't compete when corporations come in with cash. They don't need to do an appraisal, and so we're losing out. They're taking that money, that house, off the market. They're also, if they're buying 30 houses in some neighborhood, that's also then increasing the value or increasing the price of the next house that goes for sale, making, again, it's just a vicious cycle of where people can't afford it. So I think we need to look at, are there ways that we can control that market? And are there ways, you know, we need to look at, well, why are they doing it? What is their long-range plan? And because it is not helping. We have the worst disparity gap in the country between Black homeownership, which is about 25%, and white homeownership, which is about 75%. So we really need to figure out what is going on. And I think there are some ways that we can stop it, and I think there are some things that we will be looking at to try to get a better handle on that, because we need to do something to reduce that disparity gap.
And if that disparity gap is not reduced, then, you know, owning a home has always been a part of the American dream. It's how people build wealth. Are we potentially in danger of losing that aspect of the American dream?
I think we are. I think we are potentially losing the dream and the hope of the dream. I mean, how do people, you know, you pass on that generational wealth, and if you don't have that home to build that wealth, you can't pass it on. And so I think we do need to figure out, again, a way to get more people into home ownership. It might not be for everybody. Not everybody wants to own a home, but I think we need to have that option. And right now, families and people do not have the option when the end of the, I think the beginning home price in the metro area is at least $350,000.
Now, you mentioned one bill that you have authored to, you know, whittle away at this enormous problem. Are there other ideas, initiatives being put forward by the DFL caucus in particular? I know the legislature is looking at a nearly $8 billion surplus. So what might be coming down the pike to attack this problem, not just in the metro, but across the entire state of Minnesota?
Yes, the housing crisis is not just in the metro area, it is across the state. There might be different solutions in different parts of the state depending on the needs. The city of Austin has done some very creative work to try to get developers in there to help stabilize and redevelop some of their NOAA, natural occurring affordable housing, and they're having a hard time doing that. They're you know, saying, hey, we will work with you, come visit us, and they're having a hard time. And so the solution that they have might be different than the solution in my neighborhood, where we have a lot of developers that are continually looking to put in places. We spend about 1% of our budget on housing, and so I think there is a big opportunity, from the bonding bill to cash grants to putting more money into, like, the Challenge Fund, which helps, housing developers, nonprofit housing developers can apply to and cities can apply to.
Senator Carrie Dietzick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week, Governor Tim Walz and Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan unveiled their 2022 bonding proposal, which includes funding for affordable housing.
Minnesota's fiscal state is strong, as you well know. We have the capacity to be able to service our bonds, and we're proposing about $2.7 billion in all of the bonding proposals.
We've seen this time and time again when roads and bridges are deteriorating, when educational facilities are outdated, when affordable housing is unavailable, when water treatment plants are unsafe, our families and communities struggle to thrive. So many of the projects that we have included in our proposal have been waiting for years. And the longer they waited, the more critical their need became, and the more expensive the fix. But when we dedicate these resources to projects that are ready to go, we have the opportunity to make transformative change in communities and all across the state. So that is the power of bonding. We have proposed more than $450 million in safe and affordable housing projects, including a historic $250 million investment in housing infrastructure bonds to provide supportive housing to Minnesotans across the state and investments to repair existing shelters for our most vulnerable relatives and Minnesotans.
Senator Rich Dreheim is the chair of the Senate Housing Committee, and I spoke with him for his perspective on the challenges impacting access to affordable housing. Let's begin with rent control, which was passed by the voters in Minneapolis and St. Paul in the last election. In Minneapolis, city leaders will develop a plan to stabilize rents. However, in St. Paul, the voters there approved a measure that caps rental increases at 3%, which some news outlets are calling the strictest in the nation. It's also prompted some St. Paul developers to halt projects. What is your view on this?
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for talking about housing, something that I've been passionate about 5 years I've served. As far as rent control, I did carry a bill trying to close the loophole. Right now, we have a loophole in the state of Minnesota that allows cities to petition, more or less, or put it on the ballot to vote for rent control. That's the only way you can do rent control in Minnesota. Rent control is probably the most studied aspect of housing, not only in our country, but in the world. And most economists feel that it is the worst thing you can do for housing supply issues, for housing in general. It is a Band-Aid approach to a bigger problem. And it is a problem that we've been trying to fix for 5 years. And unfortunately, we've been blocked by two governors on trying to move forward with some solutions on the housing crisis that we are facing here in Minnesota.
Well, and I guess with rent control, then it potentially does stymie development. And part of the problem is that there is a lack of housing. Is that right?
Correct. So what normally happens in an environment where you impose rent control, you have less development, less new housing units. Call them more apartments in this case. So, and that's exactly what we've seen in the short time that this has passed in Minneapolis and St. Paul is there's been quite a few public comments in the paper and the media and press releases of big corporations pulling out of building new developments or even halting current projects. And that's exactly what one would expect with this type of legislation. In Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that's what's happening. And that will reduce the number of apartment units, which will artificially keep everything else really high. And it really won't go to the underlying problem is we don't have enough housing.
As you know, one factor attributed to the rise in housing prices is the fact that out-of-state corporations are coming in and buying what would be a starter home for a new home buyer, but buying up those homes, multiple homes, to either flip them into rental homes or, well, actually to make them rental homes or to flip them and then resell them. Is there a legislative solution to this?
Oh, that's a good question. And we have talked kind of offline about that. Senator Dick and myself have both expressed interest in kind of digging deeper into that and seeing if we can come up with a solution. So at the end of last session, we both kind of agreed that we thought that'd be a great topic to have a hearing on and try to see if we can find something to help that situation. I know a lot of communities, especially college communities, have restrictions on how many rental units you can have. And when you look at like Northeast Minneapolis, I think it is, has majority of the homes are rentals. So if you saved up enough money, you built up your credit and you wanted to buy a home, the chances of you finding a home to even purchase are very slim. So what can we do, as a state legislative body to help protect the availability of some of the houses, but yet still maintain kind of a free market is a balancing act. But we have to look into it. We have to examine, is this really a big problem in Minnesota? I personally have seen emails from corporations wanting to buy literally hundreds of homes in the metro area. That's very scary for that young family to start out.
Last year, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis published a report called Systemic Racism Haunts Homeownership in Minnesota. The disparities between white homeowners and homeowners who are people of color and indigenous people is, according to this report, the fourth largest in the nation. I know this is important to you because you brought it up on the Senate floor last year. Are you looking for ways to address this?
And I have, the last 5 years, we've tried to come up with solutions. You know, I truly believe one of our basic functions as a state, you know, it should be basic education for our kids, a career path job. You know, what can we do to get people on a career path job? And then the last piece of the American puzzle is a pathway to homeownership. And that's what we've been trying to work on. It is a great equalizer. And this last year was the first year in Minnesota's history we actually had bonding money for home ownership. So our focus of our state agency for housing has been on rental and not home ownership. And I think that has magnified, especially some areas in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which is the worst by most counts in the country. The state overall is usually ranked fourth or fifth. Were state, but the metros usually ranked number one in the whole country, which is awful. And that means we're giving a lot of people, or not giving a lot of people, the option to build wealth. And we do a lot of great things here in Minnesota, but that's one thing that we haven't done very well, and we need to fix that. And I think we've had a lot of solutions to try to do that. Unfortunately, we haven't got the other side of the aisle to come along with us, but I think this year will be the year to do that. Sometimes it just takes a little bit of time to get people to see your perspective, and there's things we agree on and not agree on. But government was the problem when redlining started, which was one of the causes of this. It was the big banks and government working together to block people from being able to buy a home. So right now, I think government is part of the problem. And that's the want to build more apartments instead of houses. You know, it costs us two or three times the amount to build an apartment from a government standpoint versus a free market. And when we're spending, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you mentioned bonding just a moment ago, and Governor Walz announced his bonding plan for the coming legislative session. What's pertinent to this conversation is that he'd like to put $450 million into affordable housing projects and $250 million in housing infrastructure bonds. And the legislature is also looking at an $8 billion surplus. So you said that, you know, bonding for home ownership is important to you. But are these numbers close? Is this something that state dollars should go towards?
It devil's in the details. And we have to look and see what the use will be for these bonds. But housing bonds aren't that cheap. So the debt service for the first year is 4% is what the state's been charging us to do these bonds. And then 8% for year 2 through 20. 8%. That is not very cheap. So I am pushing if we are going to do quote unquote bonding bills, we do cash bills and spend some of that cash. The dollar amounts will be figured out with leadership way above my pay grade. But I will be pushing for, if we do have the resources and we don't give some of that back, which I think we should, that we spend cash on it instead of borrowing. The housing bonds are not inexpensive. They are the highest cost bond that we have here. And we have done more bonding for housing in the last 5 years than we have in any other period in time, probably more than the last 20 years. So we've been very big supporters of housing bonds, but the system can only handle so much. And I think this is probably more than the system can handle.
Senator Rich Dreheim, I want to thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
The Minnesota State Capitol is the seat of state government, housed in an historic and beautiful building. It is also a history of portraiture, housing the collection of gubernatorial portraits spanning more than 150 years. The official state portrait of Mark Dayton, the 40th governor of Minnesota, was recently unveiled in a ceremony held in the rotunda. It hangs in the west wing of the Capitol on the ground floor in a corridor with Governor Tim Pawlenty, Governor Jesse Ventura, and around the corner, Governor Arne Carlson. These are all portraits, though, paintings, not photographs. Why is that?
Well, the importance of oil on canvas is the permanence. Because if you had a photograph, that's going to fade over time. And so the goal of the Minnesota Historical Society and the Capitol Area Architectural Planning Board is to have a piece of art that's going to be there for decades and generations to come. So you want something that's a traditional oil painting on a canvas.
These paintings differ remarkably over the years. Alexander Ramsey, Henry Sibley, those are small paintings. Some, like Governor Arne Carlson, are quite large. What explains the differences in the size and how these paintings are the decisions that are made?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story to tell about the portraits, because what you are looking at is you're looking at portraits from the 1850s all the way up to the present day. And so you get a really good story about art history and how portraits were done. So you have very traditional, very formal paintings from the 1850s, the 1890s, early 1900s, the traditional governor with the hand in the coat, you know, that type of thing. And then you start in the 1930s having a little bit more personalization of the governor. So Floyd B. Olson was the first kind of a little bit more less formal painting. He's portrayed standing in front of the Capitol. The Capitol's behind him and he's holding a microphone for the radio. And he was one of the first governors to really use that technology to have these statewide conversations over the radio. So that was kind of a nice little kind of a part of his administration as a governor, and a part of his personality, very charismatic, very outgoing.
I noticed in Governor Arne Carlson's portrait, there are two butterflies, a blue and a yellow bird. Also in Governor Jesse Ventura's, there's Rodin's The Thinker, and there's a train in the background. What do these symbols indicate?
Well, it really typifies some of their achievements as a governor. The process for the last several decades is the governor, when they finish their term of office, gets to select their portrait artist and also what they want to be portrayed as or how they want to be remembered in that portrait. So they work with the artist to work out some of those details. And so once again, if you look at some of the more recent portraits from the last 30, 40 years, you do have characteristics or things that identify that person's interest. So we can go back to El Cui, he has horses in the background. Well, he's an avid horse rider, has been his whole entire life. So those are his horses that are being portrayed in that painting. And you have Arne Carlson as the butterflies. One is a butterfly you find in Sweden. One is a butterfly you find in Minnesota because he has Swedish roots. He's a Swedish-American descent. So it makes the things very personalized for these governors to have those stories told in the portraits.
As you view all these governors' portraits, some are seated at or near a desk, some have books or flags. Governor Tim Pawlenty and Governor Mark Dayton, as is Governor Floyd Buelsen, outside. How are the settings chosen?
Well, that's a kind of a conversation between the artist and the governor. So they can pick and choose what they want as their setting. And for instance, with Pawlenty, you know, that typifies this was the center of government. This is where he worked. This is where all of his achievements were made, was in that capital. With Governor Dayton, it's really acknowledging, you know, the importance of the state capital, but he was also the leading official that led the preservation, restoration, repair of the capital. So that's a part of his legacy. That's something that you want to be remembered. Not only did you serve here, but it's a place that you helped preserve for future generations.
One portrait is distinctly different from the others, and that's the one of Governor Rudy Perpich, because it includes his wife, Lola. What's the story behind that?
Well, the tradition for any governor portrait is to have just the governor as the person in that portrait. Governor Perpich had served non-consecutive terms, so he did have his first official portrait on display here, but because he had served a second term, he wanted to have that first portrait and a new portrait on display in the Capitol. And the Capitol Area Architectural Planning Board said, well, you can only have one representation. And he wanted to have his painting with his wife, Lola. And so that brought up this whole controversy about it should be just the governor. And so he was asked not to have her in that painting. And so he had a campaign, basically put billboards on University Avenue, you know, saying that they're not letting me and my wife in the building. So, you know, it just became kind of a sticky issue for several years. And then after he passed away, the family and other supporters got money to do a portrait with Lola in that painting. So you'll see Lola and Rudy in the same painting today.
Each one of these portraits has a plaque next to it explaining the accomplishments of that governor's administration. Who writes those?
That's overseen by the Minnesota Historical Society. So we contract with historians or other people to write those biographical plaques and the information.
Is the content ever controversial?
That's the problem. If you have portraits of living people or being portrayed, sometimes it's hard to really tell their story because they're still living that story. So sometimes that can be a controversial issue. With the older governors, you know, you have a little bit of time to really see what the permanence of that legislation they might have been supporting, the effect that has. So you have a better idea of the impact that that governor did have, you know, 100 years ago.
In a sense, these portraits tell the history of the state through time. What do visitors, do they comment ever about these portraits?
There's a lot of people who will, you know, as they're walking through the building, are curious. They want to see who these people are. They know some, they recognize some from their lifetime, and so they're interested in reading about them and seeing them portrayed here. And people usually comment, it's nice to see these portraits here because it does reflect that history of Minnesota and the different people that have served as that executive officer.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.